Genesis chapter 1, we'll be looking again at verses 26 and following, where we were last week. And this comes up very early in the Bible as the foundational text for our understanding of the doctrine of man. That's what we're talking about at this point in our series on Bible doctrine. And last week we were here considering especially the statement there in verse 26, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness," and try to define that phrase scripturally, because it is a phrase that defines who we are, what it means to be human, what it is that distinguishes us from the rest of God's creation. And if you remember, I tried to boil down the different passages that use those terms with two words, both of which begin with the letter R. First of all, resemblance, that there are many ways in which we look like God, which we have the capacity to parallel His character, to display His perfections. We resemble Him in many ways, not as perfect duplicates, but there are many of His attributes that He has enabled us to reproduce. And of course, salvation is aimed at remaking us after that image, so that through Christ and by the work of the Spirit, we are more and more able to display the character of God. But there is another R, and that's what we come to this morning. Not just the fact that we look like God, but that actually we have been commissioned to stand in His place. And the word for that is the word representation. So there was resemblance, and then there's also representation. We are His representatives. And the reason that He makes us with so many similarities to Him is that He desires to delegate a certain amount of His rule to us, that we might exercise rule on His behalf. Resemblance and representation, both of those terms go into the understanding of God's image in man. Read this week about a strange example of this, but there was a wedding in Japan where the couple, at least the bride who happened to work for an electronics company, had a robot perform their wedding ceremony. The robot was the minister and had been apparently programmed with whatever information needed to go through the ceremony, and apparently it was legal. There was the comment that in Japan, robots are coming to be considered almost as humans and as people's friends, and this particular couple wanted to go that route. How could that even be? Well, whatever we might think of that, it is a good example of what I'm talking about here, because the robot was programmed with enough similarity to a human being that it could stand in the place of a human being and do what human beings are supposed to do. If you think about that reference to God, He has programmed us with enough similarity to Him that we are able to stand in His place and do things that you'd expect only God to be able to do. Well, actually, He has empowered us to stand in His place and perform a number of His roles on earth. That's what we're talking about here. And that idea is actually implicit in one of those terms for the image of God, that first word, image. You remember that it is used in the Old Testament to refer to idols. And so this idol is not only a kind of miniature copy or picture of the God that's being worshipped, but in the minds of the idol worshippers, that thing is standing in the place of their God. And so they worship it as a way of directing their worship to the real thing that stands behind it. And so it's implicit, this representation concept is implicit in the term, but it's also implicit in what it says in the very next sentence. Not implicit, actually, but very explicit. God says, "Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, birds of the heavens, livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And so God creates man in His image, and He gives him, in verse 28, what we tend to call the dominion mandate. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." This is not entirely clear in verse 26 in our translations, but actually the way it's worded in the original, that sentence, "let them have dominion," is actually expressing the purpose for which God made man in his image. You could read it this way: "Let us make man in our image after our likeness so that they may have dominion." You realize that is why we were created. So that we would stand in God's place to exercise dominion over the rest of God's world. And that's our theme this morning: created for dominion. And naturally, a lot of what we're going to say this morning has to do with our understanding of work that God has given us to do. And as soon as I say the word work, my own heart cringes. It's not a favorite topic. It's something we tend to avoid. And in addition to that, there are a lot of theological and practical dangers that can come up in talking about this subject. I feel like I do with so many of these doctrines that to say one thing, you have to cover 15 other things so that people don't misunderstand what you're saying about the one thing you're trying to get across. You're walking a tightrope here where you could fall on a whole bunch of different sides as you deal with some topic. And let me just share with you some of my pastoral concerns in covering this. First of all, I want to say that I'm not concerned, for the most part, that we are lazy people. And really, the emphasis of the message is not you need to work hard. Knowing you as I do, I think, for the most part, we are a hard-working people. In fact, if we need a message on the subject, it may be in the other direction of what comes up at the end of chapter 1, beginning of chapter 2, in the principle of the Sabbath. And the fact that there is this rest that God desires us to work into our schedule so that we are not overly burdened and therefore unproductive for Him. It's not so much about we need to get busy and do something. It's more about our thinking regarding the work. That is, are we really viewing our work as God views it? Do we have a biblical perspective, a God-oriented perspective on the work? Number two, I recognize as well that everybody's life circumstances are different, and for each individual, there are different ways in which these truths are going to apply. We're not dealing exclusively with what the world would call, what we would call, your job or gainful employment. We have people here who, for different reasons, aren't employed in what we would call a job, whether because they are unemployed at the moment, or because they are stay-at-home mothers, or because they are in their later years of life and they are retired. That's not primarily or exclusively what we're talking about. We're talking about whatever realm of responsibility God has given you at this moment in life, having the right thinking about it, viewing it as a means over through which you exercise dominion on His behalf. Number three, I also am concerned that in talking about what generally but wrongly is called the secular realm of life, and trying to make the point that ultimately all life is sacred and there's no such thing as a secular realm for the Christian, nevertheless, I think we stand the danger of minimizing the importance of what God is doing in the church and the use of our spiritual gifts in this context. We just came through several Sunday school lessons about spiritual gifts. And I'm not in any way putting that aside in trying to deal with matters outside the church. We understand, I think, that the church and God's work through the church and the direct spread of the gospel through the church and the discipling of people through the church really does have a special role in God's kingdom and God's plan for this age. And we are not minimizing it by trying to elevate our concept of the other side of things. But the fact is that the majority of your time this week, and the majority of your time, probably for the rest of your life, is going to be spent outside the doors of this building and doing things beyond what we would consider church work or something perhaps directly related to the spread of the gospel. What is the right way to think about that? We all have these responsibilities. We all have time, lots of it, that we spend outside of the context of the local church. What is the right way to view that? That's what we're dealing with. Along with that, I would say, number four, that in talking about the sacredness of everybody's calling, I think we stand the danger of minimizing the importance of what we would refer to as the call to the ministry and the special role that that kind of calling has in the plan of God. That's not our theme today. That's going to be our theme in 2 weeks at the ordination, Lord willing. So we'll come back to that, but by again, elevating the importance of these other areas, that doesn't mean we're minimizing the importance of the other. But again, the fact is, for most of you, that's not an issue, because that's not what your life mostly is directed to. It's not what God has called you to do. We have to deal with the realities that are in front of us. All of us have jobs and ministries of various kinds, and if anything, my job as a preacher is to help you understand the role of your job in the plan of God and to view it from a Christian perspective. So, got all that stuff out of the way so that we can get to the message for this morning. How is it that our work in the world fits into a Christian worldview? I hope your perspective is not that you work so you can get rich, and that it's just about accumulating as many goods and toys and experiences as you possibly can. That would be an unchristian, materialistic perspective. Somebody maybe has a little bit more spiritual thought and says, well, I work in the world, and as far as how this relates to my Christian life, this is so that I can be around lost people and make contacts with the unsaved so that I can have opportunities to witness to them. Well, I do hope you think that way. I do hope you view your work, whatever contacts you have, as an outlet for evangelism. But I would say that that is not either what we're talking about this morning. And the way to get a handle on that is to remember this. In Genesis 1, in Genesis 2, there was nobody to witness to. There were no churches to attend. There were no missionary cottages to fix up. There were no tracts to be distributed. There were no sermons to be preached. Adam spent his days in a garden. And God created him to make that place more beautiful and more productive so that God would be glorified. And even though we have this responsibility of evangelism now, that doesn't mean that the original purpose for mankind has somehow been set aside or is somehow unimportant. So what is this all about? What is the right way, the full way to think about this? Somebody might say, well, my job, I have it basically so that I can pay the bills, so that I can provide for my family, but the things that really matter in life are the quote-unquote spiritual things. And as far as what life is all about, you know, I'm thinking in terms of prayer and Bible reading and evangelism and serving God through the church and ministering to the body of Christ and using my spiritual gifts, this other, what I do, like most of the actual minutes and hours I have, is just kind of on the side. It's just kind of supplemental. It's just kind of there to give me money so that I can do the stuff that really counts as far as God's work. And I would say that is not either the intent of God. That has often been called the two-story view of life, where you spend most of your time down here working and doing kind of mundane things, but the stuff that really matters is what's going on up there on the second story. And our goal as Christians is to get out of the first story as much as we can and as often as we can so we can go up there and do the things that really count. Well, actually, it can get even more serious because thinking about that second story, the next step is to think the people that really matter to God and the people that are really serious about Him and the people that are really spiritual, well, if you are really intent on honoring God for your life, then you would become a missionary. Then you would become a pastor. And we just try to transfer as many people up into that second category as possible, because it is at that level alone and primarily that God is honored. Now, all those kinds of views, you realize it was one of the main contributions of the Protestant Reformation to get rid of that kind of bad thinking. We appreciate the Reformation for what it taught us about salvation, and that's true. But the Reformation taught us about a lot of other things. And one of the things that those men were countering was the very strong division between the clergy and the laity that had grown up in the Roman Catholic Church. And the idea, again, that the really spiritual people, the people that do something that matters, are the ones who devote themselves 100% to the church, and they hold themselves up in a monastery, or they devote themselves to some congregation of the priests, and everybody else is just kind of surviving, and the best they can do for God is to give as much money as they can to the other people, right? And there was this huge gap between the clergy and the laity, and the former said that is unscriptural. Let me read to you from one of them. This is one of the early Puritans, William Perkins. He says, "The main end of our lives is to serve God in the serving of men in the works of our calling." Some man will say, perchance, what? Must we not labor in our callings just to maintain our families? And maybe that's what it's about. I answer, this must be done, but this is not the scope and the end of our lives. The true end of our lives is to do service to God in serving of man, and that is done by everybody, clergy or laity. Everybody has a role to play, and everybody needs to view whatever God has given them to do with that objective in mind. You say, well, where did the reformers get those kinds of ideas? I would say it's not just because they were tired of a bunch of authoritative priests. They got those ideas from the Bible. And chiefly, they got it from passages like Genesis 1, 26 to 28 that brings us back to the original reason for which God created man in the first place. And so as we look at this text, I want us to consider, first of all, the meaning of this mandate. What really is happening? What does this entail when God says that He has created us in His image so that we may have dominion? Well, there's a background here. A background to the words dominion and so forth, the background to the words image and likeness. Back in those days, if a king really wanted to make the point, I'm in charge here, you better respect me and honor me and serve me as the king over this realm, you know what he would do? He would fill the countryside with statues of himself. And so there would be this region, and he'd make sure there's a statue or some kind of visual reminder of himself. So everybody knows I'm in charge here. And you go into the next sector, and they would put one there to get that same idea across. I mean, it'd be like walking into a government building today and seeing a painting of the president. All right, that's the background that Genesis is bringing to mind to the original readers. They're very used to this, but then they're reading here, I am God's kind of statue, placed here and hither and yonder and over there, spread out all over the earth, to indicate and to put on display the fact that God is the ruler here. And then, in addition to that, he uses terms like have dominion in verses 26 and 28. And we're not going to trace all this out, but sometime look up 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 24, and you'll see that that verb is one commonly used of kings. In fact, it refers there to the dominion of King Solomon over a very large realm of the people of Israel. The second word in verse 28, beyond having dominion, notice it says there, subdue it. And that's a lot stronger word. It's a lot more active word. To have dominion is to be in a position of authority. To subdue something is to actively bring it under your authority, to demonstrate, and if necessary, to demonstrate by force that you are the ruler. In fact, it's used in that way of the Israelites going into Canaan to subdue that land by dealing with the enemies that were there. Joshua chapter 18, verse 1. Now we understand that at this point, the earth, before the curse, is not in rebellion against man. But there is still a sense in which, before sin, they are still having to actively take control of the world. The world is huge. There's two of them. And they have to find ways to bring this creation under their authority, to stand in the place of God so that all of these different realms are rightly arranged under them. That's why God put them in the globe in the first place. And I would therefore, putting all that together, define the dominion mandate in these terms. God made man in order to harness the world's resources so that they reach their greatest potential for the glory of God. Let me say that again. God made us to harness the world's resources so that those resources reach their greatest potential for the glory of God. The world was good at that point. There was no sin there, but the world was not as good as it could be. The Garden of Eden was not as beautiful as it could be. And so man is there to beautify it, to make it even more pleasant to God, to make it even more honoring to Him, more beautiful. And the Garden of Eden was just one plot. You had the whole world that had to be worked on this way to harness the world's resources so that they reach their greatest potential for the glory of God. Now, we're going to talk about application after a while as we finish up, but I think just what I've said so far ought to fill our hearts with a sense of dignity. When God gives me a job to do, whatever the job happens to be, why? What is going on here? What's going on here is you are God's personal representative over that little plot of ground. Now, for His glory, you make it as useful, as profitable, as beautiful as you possibly can in your circumstances. So that God receives glory as the source of all of this. You're not a slave here. You're not a worm here. This is a position of enormous dignity. God has commissioned you as His vice regent over this. Now, of course, the glory even beyond that is that because of sin, you made yourself into a worm. And yet through Christ, He has restored you and is restoring you to glory and has converted people. We have even more cause to have a sense of dignity because God went overboard through Christ so that I could do this for Him. Is that the way that you and I think about Monday morning? Probably not. We think of it in terms of, I'll do this again. If I don't do this, I'm going to get fired. If I don't do this, I'm not going to get paid. I don't do this, I'm going to be a poor testimony. Those aren't necessarily bad motivations, but that's just not the issue as far as your being a human being in the first place. This is all about standing in God's place and making His world a more productive place for His glory. Now, secondly, there's something that has to happen in order for this to take place on any broad scale. And so I want to deal quickly with the prerequisite to the mandate. Notice that before God in verse 28 says, fill the earth and subdue it, he says, be fruitful and multiply. And procreation is an absolutely vital part of this process. Why? Because the world is a huge place, and there's no way that two people by themselves are going to be able to subdue the entire globe. There has to be a whole bunch of them. And God says, all right, as a way of exerting my influence through you over the rest of the world, I'm going to give you the ability to reproduce. And procreation becomes God's means for providing enough people to harness the resources of the entire earth. That's why if you jump ahead to chapter 9, when the human race is down to 8 people after the flood, like the first thing God says to these people is, all right, be fruitful, multiply. My influence, if it's going to be extended over the earth, there's got to be more and more people. So get busy about reproduction. And I'm bringing that up for various reasons, but one of them is this. That is, folks, how you and I need to view whatever children God blesses us with. There are other purposes and other blessings in having children. But fundamentally, what is it about? It is about God is using us to bring into this world more people that can act as His servants. That's a part of understanding our mission here. It is not merely to satisfy our personal desires. It is not merely to give us the joys of having a family. It is to produce more agents to bring God glory in the world. That shapes not only our thinking, but it shapes what we do in rearing our children. It automatically determines what are the values that you're going to work to put into them. It determines your understanding of your job and what are the ideas that you've got to be working to teach them. And not that I think this issue is a problem either, but just a reminder here, notice how it introduces the command, God blessed them and God said to them. In other words, procreation, although it is a duty here, is presented as a blessing. And when God brings children into the world, that ought to be viewed every time as an act of goodness on His part. As the psalmist writes, the children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb, His reward. So the procreation comes in as a vital part of that. But moving on, number 3, let's consider the scope of this mandate. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that this was about harnessing the world's resources. And the question that comes up is, why did I make it that broad when what this refers to is simply the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and every living thing? In other words, it's talking here about animals. Why are we broadening it out beyond animals to include everything in God's creation? Well, what is the scope of this mandate? What does it cover? And what we're dealing with here is what we saw with the image of God as well, that this is just a starting point for this doctrine. And it's really going to take the rest of the Bible to fill out the many dimensions over which we have dominion. The first thing that's mentioned here would be the most recently created thing in this chapter, which was the animal world. And so animals are referred to there. They're referred to in chapter 2 when Adam exercises dominion by giving names to all of them. They are referred to in chapter 9, again after the flood, where you're down to just a few people and where apparently the effects of sin in the animal world are increasing and there's developing more hostility between man and animals. And so God says, I am putting the fear of you in the animals. And something that he also had not said before, I am calling upon you to, you can eat the animals now at this point. And that is a part now of your exercising dominion over them. So we're not going to neglect the animals. There's an issue there. That is a part of it. And it's interesting the comment that James makes just kind of in passing in chapter 3. every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind. And that whole process of whatever goes into taming animals, making them useful for society, for God's world, is a part of the dominion mandate. And you know what that does automatically is that throws open the door to a huge field that we call science. Because apart from understanding something about how animals work and how animals mate and how you go about making use of animals and their patterns of life, which is a part one small slice of science, there's not going to be any way that you're going to effectively carry that out. So it's implicit in all of this what we refer to as science. And that opens up the door to a lot of other things. I would say number two, beyond animals, it includes agriculture. And did God not make the first man a gardener? And what does it say there in verse 29, very shortly after the dominion mandate, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth. And so God in chapter 2 in verse 15, it says that he put Adam in that garden to work it and to keep it. And that opens up a whole other realm of life there. And we're just kind of dipping in, but what you're going to find is that regarding all these topics, there could be a whole doctrine that you could develop. There's a Bible doctrine of animals. There's a Bible doctrine of agriculture and God's perspective of how we treat the earth and how we make use of it and so forth. But I'm just showing you that in this context, the responsibility is a lot broader than any one area. I think it includes as well relationships between human beings and authority structures among human beings. You start off at the end of chapter 2 talking about what? Talking about marriage. And that's our third category. So man leaves his parents and he's joined to his wife, and now you have a whole set of principles that enter into how that's supposed to function. And there's authority there because the woman is created for the benefit of, as a helper to, man. And that opens up a whole bunch of scripture on that topic. Not just about man and wife, not children, the role of that. A part of exercising dominion has to do with organizing the family in a God-honoring way. And it broadens out beyond the family to other levels of society, including, number four, what we would call civil government. Because in chapter 9 and verse 6, God says what? God says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. So now there are authorities that are going to be put in place to make sure that this thing we call capital punishment is exercised in a fair way. And that develops as Scripture goes on, to the point where Romans 13 actually comes out and says, the powers that be are ordained of God. And he has put some people in authority over other people, and those people up here, part of their dominion mandate is to exercise authority over this realm in a God-honoring, God-serving way. So the dominion mandate includes civil government. And I would say beyond that, it includes all other legitimate aspects of civilization. And you're going to find examples in the book of Genesis that have to do with the development of cities, that have to do with the development of music, that have to do with the use of weapons and tools. I mean, you name it. In principle, by way of example, all of that is getting underground in the book of Genesis, and they are all ways by which, in their place, man is making creation more useful to the glory of God. And the rest of the Bible is going to flesh out God's principles for how those different things ought to be handled. All other legitimate aspects of civilization. Let me read something to you here. And then we'll talk about application. The author is referring to the words of Genesis 1. And he says, these words plainly declare the vocation of the human race to rule. They also call him to progressive growth in culture. Far from being something in conflict with God, cultural achievements are an essential attribute of the nobility of man as he possessed it in paradise. Inventions and discoveries, the sciences and the arts, refinement and ennobling, in short, the advance of the human mind, are throughout the will of God. They are the taking possession of the earth by the royal human race, the performance of a commission imposed by the Creator, by God's ennobled servants, a God-appointed ruler's service for the blessing of this entire realm. Now somebody says, didn't the Bible say, don't love the world, neither the things that are in the world? And what I'm saying is we need to make a distinction between the world and, more generally, civilization and culture. There is a godless way to approach culture, but culture itself is something God intends and designs. The author along those lines says this: what the Bible rejects and what is opposed to God is not culture in itself, but the estrangement of millions of its representatives from God, the separation of sinners from heaven, lack of consideration for one's neighbors, the spirit of arrogance and rebellion, in brief, the revolt against the Most High. But the call to be ruler signifies a vocation to advancing civilization and is a God-given regulation in creation. That comes from the British author Eric Sawyer in a book called The King of the Earth. In that title, is that how you view yourself? It's a wonderful and biblical way to think of whatever it is God has given you to do. He has made me, under him, the little king over this realm. It's a great privilege. It's a great opportunity. Now, how does that apply? Beyond just our attitude in our work, number four, and finally, the application of the mandate. And to this point, I'd like you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, because it's at this point that it becomes more personal for us. And this was another great truth recovered by the Reformation, and it's what we call the doctrine of vocation or calling. And by way of application, my first point is this: that if we are intent on carrying this out, here's what we need to do. Determine the specific calling through which God wants you to exercise dominion. You yourself are not going to be able to rule the entire earth. But God is giving you some smaller, specific realm over which he designs you to rule. And that's indicated here in 1 Corinthians. If you look with me in verse 17... as Paul is dealing with the question of, you know, some people are married, some are not, some are in these circumstances, some are in other circumstances, what should we be trying to do? It says, let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. And specifically, look with me later on in the passage, at verse 20, each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a slave when called? Even in that case, if somebody is a slave out in society, do not be concerned about it. Now he says, if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. So that sometimes what we refer to as God's calling may change in our circumstances, and God may open things up, or God may lead us in different ways. But he says, look, for the time being, you need to think of that as your specifically chosen place for you. God has assigned that place for you with your name on it, individually. This is the realm over which you have been called to exercise dominion. It includes your job. It includes the rest of your circumstances. It includes your background, it includes your family, it includes your relationships in society. It is not just a matter of happenstance, it is a matter of God's appointment. And as you find whatever that role is, That is the place in which God has put you to exercise dominion. Paul Helm has put it this way. And again, this is so encouraging. I had to remind myself of this week. A person to whom the Lord has not given the intellect of Einstein or the torso of Hercules is not responsible for what he lacks. And he ought not to be consumed with anxiety or envy on that score. On the other hand, he has been given certain gifts. God has called him to one kind of life, and it is for him to assess what that life is and to live it responsibly before God. In other words, if you are just not cut out for something, and you find yourself frustrated, why can't I do that? Why am I not good at that? Why does it seem that I can never make progress in that realm? Forget about it. Don't let it bother you. That's just not what God has called you and gifted you to do. That's just not the realm He has put you in dominion over. This is a liberating thing, in addition to being a dignifying thing. Because it tells me what I'm supposed to do, but also what I don't need to worry about doing, because that's just not my vocation. Don't worry about it. Don't be anxious over it. Don't be jealous of other people who get to do that. They're not doing it because they're any better. They're doing it because that's just what God chose for them in His grace. Now, a few other things. Once we get straightened out and understand God's calling, we need to learn to view our calling as a meaningful way of serving God. This is not just a waste of time. This is not just about making a paycheck. This is the area in which I am serving God. Listen to this. Here again, it's so powerful because Paul is speaking to slaves. And if this is true for a slave, how much truer would it be for those of us who are free from that kind of oppression? He says, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. Can you imagine some slave out there, and maybe he is being abused, it's just a totally unfair situation, and yet, by the grace of God, he's able to look up at his master and do whatever his master tells him. And his attitude is, I'm not doing this for you, buddy. This is for God. This is an offering presented to God. And so I do it with zeal, and I do it with joy. Again, if that's the slave learning to think that way, how much more does it apply to us in our freedom? And how many areas of life would this just revolutionize our thinking? I mean, I was out in the yard yesterday, and I had occasion to think, you know, as things are shaping up and looking better, just looking at it at the end and saying, oh, God, I hope you're happy with this. I'm trying to make this look better for you. I want this little plot of ground to look good for you. I want you to look down on this and be happy. That's how we need to learn to think about every little thing God has put in our hands to do. And certainly, number three, it calls us to work with integrity and excellence. Whether therefore you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And it calls us to approach whatever field God has put us in from a Christian perspective and just make sure that the principles that are guiding us, the way in which we are approaching that, the foundational bases of the whole thing really are in keeping with Scripture. I'm not going to have the time to develop that, but we have much to think on, much to be encouraged about, the glory of being created for dominion.